Hi, Marco Werman here. 2022 is just around the corner. Our team at The World has so many stories we plan to bring you in the new year. More stories from more places, more deep dive investigations, more music from around the globe, and more of the nuanced, human-centered international reporting you rely on. You've heard me say it here before, we just can't do it alone. We need your help. To everyone who has already donated to our fundraiser this year, thank you so much. Your support means everything. We are still short of our goal, but luckily our deadline has been extended. We have until December 31st to raise $67,000. As of right now, we're halfway there. If you haven't donated yet, please make your gift today to help power the world for another year. You can donate at theworld.org/give. Thank you, and now the show.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
Biden and Putin have a sit down. At the heart of the discussion, Ukraine.
For Putin personally, Ukraine doesn't exist. Ukraine, it's occupied territory.
But do Biden and the West have what it takes to stand up to the Kremlin? Also, the price of food has gone up so much in Lebanon, many people are not sure where their next meal is coming from.
We cannot stay like this. We need something to happen. We need a rescue plan.
And after the White House announces a diplomatic boycott of China's Winter Olympics, Beijing punches back. Translation, there will be consequences. I'm Marco Werman, plus a great Christmas tree shortage of 2021. Western Canada has a few.
They're all brown. Yeah, they are. Like, it just looks ugly.
And that's all coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is good to have you here. We start off with a high-stakes meeting, the virtual one today between President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin. They sat at conference tables a half a world apart.
Hello.
Добрый день.
Good to see you again.
Things started friendly, but got tense pretty quickly. At the top of their agenda, the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. In recent months, Russia has been significantly building up its military presence along Ukraine's border. The fear is another Russian incursion like the one Putin launched in 2014. For the latest, we're now joined by The World's Daniel Offman. So before we even talk about this two-plus-hour meeting between Biden and Putin today, Daniel, remind us how we got to this troubling point.
Well, this goes as far back as 2014 when Russia invaded Ukraine, illegally annexed Crimea, and supported a separatist military incursion in eastern Ukraine. There have been more than 14,000 casualties and many more injuries as well. And the conflict between Russia and Ukraine has been ongoing ever since.
And what has happened this year?
So in recent months, Russia has been building up its military presence near Ukraine. So this started back in April, and it's somewhat increased more recently. About 100,000 Russian troops are currently stationed near Ukraine. And as a result, the U.S. has been warning its allies, along with Ukraine, and sharing the most recent intelligence on Russian troop movements near that border.
Right, and concern has grown as those troop numbers have grown. That brings us to today's virtual meeting between Biden and Putin. Starting with Biden, what was his message to the Russian president?
Well, in the meeting, Biden's top goal was to communicate to Putin that if Russian troops do in fact enter Ukraine, there will be major repercussions. So, for example, Russia would be cut off from the international financial system. There would be harsher direct sanctions against Kremlin officials. And also the U.S. has signaled that it would send more troops to NATO countries like Lithuania and Poland. But Biden and the U.S. want to de-escalate the situation. They want to find a diplomatic pathway forward that's not dictated by Russian military pressure.
And what was Putin's message to Biden?
Well, for a long time, Russia has been frustrated with the way things have been developing in Ukraine. That's how the conflict started in the first place. So Russia's red line for many years has been that Ukraine can never join NATO. In fact, Putin asked for legal guarantees that NATO would not expand further to the east, to Ukraine. But now, in a way, Russia has shifted the goalposts. Now Russia is saying that it doesn't want the U.S. to provide military support to Ukraine. And that may be the new red line for Russia. I spoke with Mikhail Osamas. He's the director of the new Geopolitics Research Network in Kyiv. He's also a veteran of Ukraine's military.
For Putin personally, Ukraine doesn't exist. Ukraine, it's occupied territory. So for Ukraine, it's absolutely understandable that Putin could act to get Ukraine.
So as Sama said there, in Putin's mind, Ukraine has always been within Russia's sphere of influence alone, and NATO or U.S. support clashes with that understanding.
So this is one meeting between Biden and Putin. Where does this go from here?
Well, when Biden came into office, he didn't want to restart the relationship with Russia the way previous administrations had. He took on a more realistic approach. That is, on one hand, working together in areas of mutual interest, and at the same time being vocal and standing up for American values when Russia crosses the line. So the U.S. wants a stable relationship with Russia so that it could focus on other adversaries, like China, for example. What's clear, though, is that Russia does not accept that kind of posture from the U.S. Russia will use any means necessary to improve its standing as the Kremlin sees it, and everything is on the table, including military action.
The World's Daniel Hoffman giving us a lowdown on today's virtual meeting between President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Daniel, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
When a U.S. newspaper prints something libelous, lawsuits are often quick to follow. Social media companies, though, they can escape unscathed. That's because federal law gives websites broad protection against liability for content posted by others. Still, that has not stopped Rohingya refugees from suing Facebook for $150 billion this week. The refugees who now live in the U.S. and the U.K. say the social media company should take responsibility for algorithms that amplified hate speech. They charge the platform with failing to take down inflammatory posts that they say facilitated genocide when some 10,000 Rohingya Muslims were killed during a military crackdown in Myanmar in 2017. To find out more about the lawsuit and its odds of success, we reached out to Anupam Chander. He's a professor at Georgetown University Law Center. Anupam, what exactly is Facebook, which is now known as Meta Platforms? What are they being accused of by these Rohingya refugees?
They're being accused of basically putting out a defective product. Their product is an internet speech platform. The plaintiffs argue that platform was not ready for the content that would be generated in Myanmar. The plaintiffs are claiming that the platform has emphasized engagement, and material that is most engaging is the one that's most emotional. And among the most emotional of material is hate speech. And so hate speech was amplified by algorithms that are designed to promote engagement. That's a theory that the plaintiffs have. And therefore, Facebook should be liable because it designed platforms that emphasized engagement.
So that engagement took the form of some pretty insidious things. Like, I recall one post said something like, "We will fight them," i.e. the Rohingya, "the way Hitler did the Jews." What were some of the other things that you've been seeing?
So they basically tried to paint the Rohingya as, you know, and I don't want to use terrible images, foreign infestation into our country that should be removed.
So Facebook admitted in 2018 that it had not done enough to prevent the incitement of violence and hate speech against the Rohingya. So why is this case just not a slam dunk?
The issue here is whether or not an internet platform is liable for the speech of its users. And you mentioned the critical federal statute that really has helped make the internet what it is today, for good and bad. So that federal statute basically says that internet platforms will not be considered publishers of their users' speech, and therefore they won't be liable if someone says something wrong, and they won't be liable if they suppress speech, and they won't be liable if they allow speech. So a really broad immunity from civil liability for platforms that are hosting speech of users. The idea there is that the Congress thought that the internet offered a true forum for diversity of voices, and Congress wanted to promote that diversity of voices. It said so directly in that statute.
Lawsuits like these, Anupam, seem to gain momentum when Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen spoke out in recent months. I mean, she said 87% of the spending on combating misinformation at Facebook is spent on English content, but only about 9% of Facebook users post in English. That would seem to be a big part of the problem here.
Absolutely. And actions like this help highlight the important role of Facebook across the world. And your own news program is helping highlight this by drawing attention. So one of the reasons why Facebook spends most of its money dealing with fires in the United States and a few jurisdictions is because the media spends most of its time focused on those fires. And so that's where its public relations risks tend to be highest. And in this case, by saying, hey, look, you know, we're interested when things go wrong elsewhere, is critical to convince Facebook that it's worth the investment to actually have sufficient content moderation across the world. I think it's learning that lesson slowly. Facebook was banned briefly in Myanmar earlier this year after the military coup there. And then Facebook decided to ban the Myanmar military in turn when it returned. So I think it's learned that lesson in its own way.
Anupam Chander is a professor at Georgetown University Law Center, speaking with us about a $150 billion lawsuit Rohingya refugees have launched against Facebook and its parent company, Meta Platforms, alleging it spread hate speech and facilitated genocide in Myanmar. Thank you very much for explaining this, Anupam.
Thank you, Marco.
If you're having a hard time finding a Christmas tree this year, cast your eyes north to Canada. On a normal year, Canada exports more than 2 million trees to the United States. But this year, Christmas trees are in short supply, so Canadians are keeping most of them for themselves. From Ontario, Anita Elash reports.
At Chicadee Christmas Trees Tree Farm, just west of Toronto, Andrea Stater and Ben Smith have found the perfect specimen.
Yay!
Don't make this nice.
Not too big, and we like trees that are not perfect.
In their native Austria, they'd normally cut their tree on Christmas Eve. But when they heard about a tree shortage here, they bundled up 2-year-old Ben and set off on a tree-cutting expedition. Andrea says they just couldn't risk missing out.
That would be very sad. I love the smell of it. I could not have a fake tree. It's part of Christmas.
Allison McCrindle, who owns Chicadee Christmas Trees, says customers have been desperate to find a tree this year.
We opened last weekend and I had some phone calls, people saying, do you have any Christmas trees left? And I said, oh yeah, we still have Christmas trees left.
Demand for trees is at an all-time high, a trend that started last year as people stayed home during the pandemic. But this year, production is down by 20%, according to the Canadian Christmas Trees Association. Extreme weather conditions caused by climate change left tree farmers like Arthur Lowen in Chilliwack, B.C., scrambling to salvage their crops.
In my 50 years of growing Christmas trees, we've never had a heat dome, and we've never had 29 inches of rain in November like we did this year. I have never experienced that before. This is totally new.
Lowen says a lot of trees growing in Western Canada were burned to a crisp this summer after temperatures in BC soared to 113 degrees.
People drive by the road and it says, Art, what happened to your trees? They're all brown. Yeah, they are. Like, it's just looks ugly.
Last month, those trees were under 4 feet of water after record floods. On the other side of the country, in Ontario and Quebec, a late spring frost damaged much of the crop there. At Chicadee Christmas Trees, Allison McCrindle and her staff were doing a brisk business last Friday, trimming and wrapping the trees they still had left.
We don't really like to disappoint, especially long-time customers, and possibly we will be disappointing some people because we're possibly going to close so early.
It takes at least 10 years for a tree to grow big enough to cut. McCrindle says that's why the tree shortage will last for some time to come.
It's not like something you can just change in a, you know, all of a sudden, oh, let's plant some more trees and they'll be ready next year. It's going to take time for that to change.
This year, she expects to sell out within days. For The World, I'm Anita Elash, Cambridge, Ontario.
Coming right up, countries host the Olympics to get some positive PR. With China and the new diplomatic boycott from Washington, could the strategy backfire? You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Yesterday, the Biden administration announced a diplomatic boycott of the upcoming Beijing Winter Olympics. Today, the reaction from China. Let's hear more about that reaction from The World's Rebecca Canther. She joins us from Shanghai. Rebecca, the Biden administration says that no American politicians or officials will attend the games, although American athletes will attend. How is China responding?
Well, yesterday, before the announcement even came out, Zhao Lijian, he's the China Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokesperson, he had strong words at a daily press conference. Basically, he said, "We didn't even invite American politicians, so this hyping of diplomatic boycott is just wishful thinking and grandstanding."
So what's been the news and reaction since the announcement's been made?
Well, there was another press conference today, and the spokesperson issued another statement. In this one, he angrily denied U.S. accusations of genocide in Xinjiang. And he also shot back. He said America's historic treatment of Native Americans was a more fitting example of genocide, and he issued a warning to the U.S. He's saying the U.S. is shooting itself in the foot with this boycott, and they will pay the price for this. There will be definite consequences. So I spoke to Wu Xinbo. He's the director of the Center for American Studies at Fudan University in Shanghai. He said the boycott could backfire.
Boycotting Olympics is not the right way to express your opinions on political issues. And also, it just doesn't work. You cannot rule out the possibility that in the future, China may retaliate.
Marco, nobody is yet saying how China might retaliate, though. But usually, we can expect something like a tit-for-tat move. So could it be a boycott of the 2028 Olympics in L.A., or maybe it's something more immediate?
Right. What about everyday Chinese, Rebecca? What are they saying? Is this a concern for them?
Well, you know, the foreign ministry spokesperson said this was a huge affront to 1.4 billion Chinese people. I talked with a few people around China, and that's just not the feeling I got from them. I didn't sense a huge reaction. I talked with Dong Dongyang. She's a teacher in Shanghai, and she laughed when I asked for her reaction to the diplomatic boycott. She said, as long as the athletes are still coming, that's all that's important. The diplomats don't have much of a role, she said. If they don't come, that doesn't matter at all. So from her perspective, a diplomatic boycott is meaningless. She wasn't moved by accusations of human rights abuses either. She says, as an ethnic minority, she feels well treated and she feels very hopeful about her life in China. I also talked with David Zhang. He's a tour guide up in Beijing. He said he was unsurprised.
I think this nothing out of my expectation. But I was depressed because there are so much political things mixing the sports.
He says he doesn't like the mixing of sports and politics, and he said he wishes the Olympics could really be a chance to bring people together.
So I think a big question, Rebecca, is going to be whether other countries now follow suit after the U.S. announcement of a diplomatic boycott. Do we have any sense of that yet?
Well, yeah, it's only 2 months to the start of the game, so we can expect any announcements to come soon. So Russian President Putin was invited by China, and they are hopeful he will attend, although he's not finally confirmed. New Zealand is not sending a delegation, but they say it's related to COVID concerns. And now Japan, Taiwan, Germany, Canada, and Australia are all mulling their responses. Italy and France are not likely to boycott because they will be hosting upcoming Olympic Games. And there might be more friction in the weeks ahead. There's a vote this week in the U.S. House of Representatives that would aim to punish China for treatment of Uyghur Muslims, and that may trigger another strong reaction here in China.
The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai telling us about China's reaction to the U.S. diplomatic boycott of the Winter Olympics in Beijing just 2 months away. Rebecca, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Still on the Olympics tip, let's turn to the concept of sports washing. That's when countries use sports to clean up an image that needs some help. Many are accusing Beijing of doing just that with the Winter Games. Bruce Kidd is a former Olympian and professor emeritus for sport and public policy at the University of Toronto. What do you make of the Biden administration's decision to not have officials go to Beijing but still allow the athletes to compete?
Making that distinction is valuable. Certainly, it enables international sport to continue. It enables the athletes and coaches who've worked so hard to get there to pursue their aspirations in competition. It enables the International Festival of Sport, which I think has a soft diplomatic role to play in this very frightening world. Maybe it will take the superpower politics out of sport and allow it to be more of what it was intended to be, an exchange of sport and culture. And in fact, that was the original purpose of the Olympic Games at another very difficult time for the world, is to bring people together because of differences, to engage in intercultural exchange and education as a way of lowering the temperature, of developing respect among peoples to head off a hot war. I genuinely experienced that when I competed in Tokyo and when I attended other games.
I mean, athletes are the action of the games. If you don't have athletes, no games, and that would really draw attention to the human rights abuses in China. Couldn't you argue that athletes actually have the most power to send a message?
Athletes have symbolic power, and they also have voices. I believe the IOC should protect athletes from speaking out wherever they are in the world. I think we're in this complicated world of expressing your concern about human rights without completely withdrawing your presence in the form of a boycott.
So as I asked that question, Bruce, about athletes' power to send a message, it occurred to me that there are Western companies that are doing business in Xinjiang. Are we putting too much pressure on athletes to be the arbiters of change? I mean, who do you think has the moral imperative to do something?
In the world today, trade with China is growing by leaps and bounds. There's not a person I know in the world today that isn't wearing a garment that has been made in China. And so if we're going to put pressure on China, it's got to be much more comprehensive and sustained and sophisticated than simply withdrawing from a two-week sport festival.
The International Olympic Committee has been looking at a strategy to be more aware of human rights abuses. Are you saying that it might be a system that monitors human rights abuses and, like, the IOC could confiscate the games from a country so boycotts like this are actually avoided?
It is wrestling with how to bring human rights into the requirements for major games. But still, for the most part, it adheres to the principle of non-intervention as a way of allowing international sport to continue. And the Olympic movement hasn't abandoned that ambition. It is wrestling with how to bring human rights into the requirements for major games. I mean, if we imposed a strict human rights standard on international sport, I don't know of any country in the world where you could easily stage the Olympic Games. Certainly my country, Canada, has been guilty of genocide. The failure to honor the treaties with the Indigenous people and the forced removals of Indigenous people, their incarceration as children in residential schools and so on. So the point of this is, if you live in a glass house, it's very hard to throw stones.
Former Olympian for Team Canada, Bruce Kidd. Today, he's a professor emeritus of sport and public policy at the University of Toronto. Bruce, thanks very much for your thoughts.
You're more than welcome.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. A man was picked up in Florida by U.S. immigration authorities. They wanted to deport him. There was one big problem, though, as the man from Philadelphia explained.
I am and have always been a citizen of the United States.
A one-time mistake or a recurring problem? That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. After 16 years, we've got to learn a new name. Tomorrow, Germany's Angela Merkel is stepping down and a government under a new chancellor begins. Olaf Scholz is a name you now need to know. Just how different will things be? Well, for starters, Scholz is leading a coalition of three different political parties, each with very different ideas. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry has our story.
Dare to modernize. That's the slogan adopted by Germany's new coalition government. And it's something new Chancellor Olaf Scholz talks about a lot.
Wir wollen uns etwas zutrauen,
We want to take on climate protection, restructure our industry and modernize the country, Scholz said. That was on the same day that the three parties announced they had formed a government. Scholz says together they are undertaking the biggest industrial modernization of Germany in more than 100 years. Achieving that is going to take some work. This is an unlikely coalition. It's made up of the left-leaning Social Democrats, pro-business Free Democrats, and then the Greens. Their first challenge is to figure out how to work with each other. Gustav Kressel is with the European Council on Foreign Relations.
It will be quite difficult, especially in foreign policy. So amongst the different groups that basically hammered out the coalition agreement, foreign and security policy were one of the most disputed ones.
Sorting out internal disputes on foreign policy will fall on the shoulders of Annalena Baerbock from the Green Party. She's taking up the job of foreign minister. Baerbock was a fierce critic of China for various human rights abuses when she was in the opposition. That's something Angela Merkel's government generally didn't do. China is hoping to avoid any big confrontation with Germany over human rights. Here's Foreign Affairs spokesman Zhao Lijian speaking through an interpreter.
We hope that the new German government will continue its pragmatic policy towards China, move in the same direction as the Chinese side, and develop bilateral relations on the basis of mutual respect, equality, and mutual benefit.
But just a few days ago, Baerbock told a German newspaper that she plans to take a tougher line with China. The Chinese embassy in Berlin responded quickly, saying the world needs bridge builders instead of wall builders. It's not just foreign policy where Baerbock is looking to make a mark. Her Green Party has big climate goals too. And German environmentalists like Antje von Bruck have high expectations.
This is the most ambitious coalition contract we have seen in terms of climate protection.
Von Bruck is with Friends of the Earth Germany. She tells me she's impressed by the new government's plans to phase out coal use by 2030. That's 8 years ahead of schedule. And she welcomes the coalition's proposal to boost the share of electricity generated by renewables to 80% by the same year. But von Bruck says, for now, it's all just talk.
Of course, everything that we've seen so far written in the paper is to be proved by action. And we are all very eager to see how the government will start their work and prove that they really aim for what is written down.
The government has made big promises on migration policy too. It plans to make family reunification for refugees easier and to offer dual citizenship to migrants living in Germany. Karl Kopp with the refugee rights group Pro Asyl likes what he's hearing.
Concerning Europe, they said, and this is amazing, they want to make efforts with our European partners to end the death on the Mediterranean as well as the suffering at Europeans' external borders.
But Kopp says there's been little mention of what the coalition actually plans to do about the thousands of migrants currently stranded in Belarus, hoping to cross the border into the European Union.
There was no voice to say, hey, get real, let us find a humane solution, a dignified solution for the people who are trapped there in the border region. We have to rescue them. This clear statement I missed.
Throughout her years as Chancellor, Angela Merkel could be counted on to take a cautious but steady approach. And that includes the relationship with Washington. Now many are wondering if the new government will take a different path. Gustav Kressel with the European Council on Foreign Relations says don't count on it.
A lot of things in the transatlantic relations might become gradually better, but it's not that we will move mountains here. I mean, the Greens are much more willing to talk straight on Russia and China, but I would urge great caution whether Germany would really be willing and capable to do much more than it already does.
Tomorrow, Olaf Scholz starts his first official day as Germany's new leader. But relations with the US and any disagreements with China are unlikely to be at the top of his agenda. Before anything else, the new chancellor needs to prove that he can deal with yet another wave of COVID-19. For the world, I'm Orla Barry.
The rushed departure of US troops from Afghanistan in August was widely criticized inside and outside of the US. Today, people in the United Kingdom are leveling that same criticism at how their own military left Afghanistan and how the British government was unprepared. A whistleblower is calling the British Foreign Office dysfunctional and chaotic and says the foreign secretary was slow to respond to the crisis. Dominic Raab, the former foreign secretary, says the UK did a good job and evacuated 15,000 people. Andrew Fox is with us to discuss this. He's a former British soldier and veteran of Afghanistan. He joins us from Surrey in England. What are some of the details emerging today that stand out for you, Andrew, that have brought this story back into focus months later?
The key revelations are from the whistleblower that you've already mentioned, and he's really leveled a number of criticisms of the way that our civil servants ran the operation. So the office was understaffed. Phone calls and emails from Afghans asking for evacuation weren't answered. The foreign secretary stayed on holiday and was slow to respond to requests for decisions from his staff. The top civil servant was on holiday as well. And on top of that, there's allegations that a gentleman who ran a dogs charity had his animals prioritized.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the big headlines, and we did not know a lot about that one. I mean, we've heard people say they knew the withdrawal from Afghanistan was messy, but the details that are now emerging seem surprising. A lot of pleas, for example, from people in Dari and people at the British Embassy didn't understand Dari. Are you surprised?
Not really. Today's revelations have really confirmed what I thought I already knew. You know, it was immensely challenging. And you can imagine, you know, a small office in London overwhelmed at short notice by 150,000 emails, you know, with only 10 days to try and process them. And only 5% of those 150,000 is what we had capacity for to evacuate. And so, you know, these civil servants did face incredibly difficult decisions to make. So my sympathy is in some ways with them in that sense. But in no way was this a sort of joined up, slick, cross-government department operation.
You were also trying to help evacuate Afghans following the collapse of the Afghan government. Describe for us what that was like. What did you experience?
It was interesting because once one Afghan had my phone number, it seemed that most of Kabul did. So my WhatsApp kind of blew up over that period. And it was a matter of trying to sort of triage the applicants that I was getting and help them through the process. So, you know, you'd show them where the right forms were, show them what evidence they'd need to submit. And it was quite harrowing because these were people who were in desperate fear of their lives, begging you for help. One former army officer sat on my couch trying to process probably over 100 people asking me to try and help them. It was an extremely challenging time, but nothing compared to what guys and girls from my own regiment were going through out on the ground in Kabul.
So what do you think the UK should have done differently, or are the problems even deeper and more systemic?
I think it would have been a far better move to start processing applicants quicker before Kabul fell. So we've known for a year, 12 months before August that we were going to have to start moving people out. You know, I think it was well known that the Taliban would be taking back over. I mean, I don't think anyone anticipated it to happen quite as quickly as it did. But we've got this situation where we know we have to take people out, and yet we don't properly engage with giving them visas and getting them flights until everything's falling apart around us. And, you know, that really set everything up to fail. And I don't think our efforts to extract people were ever going to save everyone that we needed to in that short 10-day window that we had back in August.
Andrew, are you still working with the UK government to help evacuate Afghans?
Yeah, I'm working with a charity, and we are sponsoring a number of Afghans who are still over there as they go through a process of trying to apply for extraction. So we're providing safe houses, we're providing a passage across the border into Pakistan and visas for that. And we're trying to put pressure on the government over here to authorise their visas. Most of them are, you know, senior officials in the previous regime, so female judges, female prosecutors, or their former Afghan National Army soldiers whose lives are under threat if they get caught.
You know, as I think about the parallels between the evacuation of the U.S. and the U.K. in Afghanistan, I'm just wondering, were the U.K.'s operations reliant on the U.S. in any way?
Oh, very much so. The U.K. contribution towards that operation was far too small to secure Kabul airport on their own. So the British were entirely dancing to the American drum in many ways, because we had to get all our people out whilst the Americans were still securing the airport. And we had to leave when the Americans decided that was the end of the operation. So in terms of British agency, when it came to the Kabul operation, I think we'd have liked to stay, but we had no option to do so.
The news from this whistleblower is really drawing a lot of attention in the UK today. What reactions have you been hearing?
Shock and outrage. I think, you know, it's painted a far worse picture than even the most hardened cynics thought that the situation had been. I think we do have to be slightly careful. It's only, you know, what you call single source intelligence. It's just one fairly junior civil servants' observations about how things were run. But it, you know, as I said, it's very much has the ring of truth from someone who was very, very slightly involved during that period. The chaos and the impenetrability of the system certainly tallies with a lot of what that whistleblower said.
Andrew Fox is a retired British soldier and veteran of the war in Afghanistan, speaking with us from Surrey, England. Andrew, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
You might have heard our story recently about snow leopards in the mountains of Kyrgyzstan. If you didn't, head over to theworld.org to listen to the sounds the leopards make. And while you're there, you also really need to check out the photos. Snow leopards prowling their habitat and staring down the camera with piercing eyes. The snow leopards of Kyrgyzstan on our website. That's theworld.org. It is a question no one wants to ask. Where is my next meal going to come from? More and more people in Lebanon are facing that dilemma these days due to the economic collapse there. The country's currency has lost much of its value. Things have gotten so bad that the Lebanese government has ended subsidies for basic goods like fuel and medicine. One estimate says nearly 8 out of 10 people in Lebanon are living in poverty. The World's Shirin Jafari met some people in Beirut trying to lend a hand to those in need.
It's almost lunchtime, and a minivan is speeding through Beirut's traffic. The driver is racing to deliver his cargo to a local mosque. He makes this same run every day of the week. The cargo is boxes of hot meals made in the morning, ready to be handed out to those in need. The Sidani Mosque is on the northern side of town, in a working-class area. Volunteers at the mosque are offloading the boxes of food and carrying them to the main kitchen inside. A huge pot of rice sits on the stove.
Smells good.
After the boxes of food are neatly piled up, the volunteers take a quick break. And then it's go time. Dozens of people start to stream into the mosque. Men, women, children, Tupperware in hand. Volunteers scoop up lentils and rice from a giant pot and fill each person's container. Today, everyone gets an additional box of food thanks to this morning's delivery from a local food bank. This mosque used to hand out 30 or so meals a day, but now it's more than 200. Lebanon is experiencing its worst economic crisis in decades. Basic food items like rice, bread, and cooking oil cost about 10 times what they did 2 years ago. The World Food Program says an unprecedented number of people now rely on food assistance, many of them for the first time in their lives. Forty-year-old Manal Salam is here to pick up some food for her family. She used to be a seamstress, but about a year ago, she lost her job. Salam's husband works as a chauffeur, but she says with fuel prices sky high, he has been working a lot less lately. Manal says they have a 10-year-old daughter and that her family now relies on the food distributed here at the mosque. She comes here about 4 times a week, she tells me. Further down the line is Nawaf Basis, a 55-year-old who fled Aleppo, Syria. She has lived in Lebanon for 8 years. The food she picks up here, she says, will feed her, her husband, and their 5 kids. She says she doesn't know what she would do if this mosque stopped distributing free food. Like Nawaf, most people here are Syrian refugees. Since the start of the war in 2011, Lebanon has taken in about 1.5 million Syrians. Many were struggling to get by even before the current economic crisis began. Today, the United Nations estimates that 9 out of 10 Syrian families in Lebanon are living in extreme poverty.
We cannot stay like this. We need something to happen. We need a rescue plan.
Soha Zeter heads a charity called the Lebanese Food Bank.
There's no more people that don't need help. Everyone needs help because of the bank issue.
She says in the past year, the food bank has seen a spike in the number of people who need help. And the government, she says, is failing to provide assistance.
The Ministry of Social Affairs, they don't have any help. They don't have any funds. They don't have any sources to help. And we don't have any support from them.
Instead, she says the ministry sends aid recipients to her organization to provide help. Meanwhile, as food prices soar in Lebanon, people like Hanna Mikhail are experimenting with ways to help people become more self-sufficient.
Hi, nice to meet you. Nice to meet you.
We meet off a busy street near a small plot of open land. That's a rare sight in overdeveloped Beirut. For the past 2 years, Mikhail has been encouraging people in Lebanon to learn about where their food comes from and maybe even try their hands at growing things at home.
There's a need for agriculture, for planting and for food. We need people. We need people to plant. We are not asking for 4 million Lebanese to be farmers, but at least we are asking that the agricultural land that should be respected.
Mikhail says land disputes and overdevelopment means less area for growing food. He says Lebanon can't afford that anymore. Mikhail started a Facebook group in 2020 called Izra. The Arabic word means to plant. The group now has more than 100,000 members. They exchange ideas about farming and gardening. Growers post pictures of their produce for sale online. Mikhail says the response has been good.
I won't say the home gardening can be a solution for the food security. It's not and it won't be. But whenever you see that people are interested to eat what they grow, this is a very important thing to note.
Last week, Lebanon's government opened up registration for a cash card program with the help of a loan from the World Bank. It's an initiative to help families purchase daily necessities. After just 24 hours, the program reportedly saw more than 31,000 people sign up. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari, Beirut, Lebanon.
Here in the U.S., it is ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that detains undocumented immigrants and does the processing for deportation. But mistakes do happen, and sometimes U.S. citizens are arrested and detained too. The World's Daisy Contreras reports.
Peter Sean Brown was born in Philadelphia, but in 2018, he found himself held at an immigration detention center in Florida after ICE officials picked him up from a county jail. They thought he was in the country illegally, and they wanted to deport him to Jamaica.
I've been wrongly accused and threatened with deportation from ICE. I am and have always been a citizen of the United States.
That's Brown months later in a TV appearance. Immigration officials released him after he showed his U.S. birth certificate.
I would never have expected it in a million years that this would happen, and I can tell you it's not a good feeling.
Brown's case isn't unique. A recent government report found that ICE detains about 50 to 100 U.S. citizens each year, and it criticized its record-keeping. Vasudha Tala is an immigration lawyer with the ACLU of Northern California who's suing ICE over these detentions. She's currently helping a U.S. citizen who spent a month in ICE custody in California. The client, Brian Buclay, was born in the British Virgin Islands and came to the U.S. as a baby. He's a U.S. citizen through his parents.
He had a citizenship certificate from various siblings who had become citizens at the same time he did. He had his dad's naturalization certificate, and he had very clear evidence that his mom had also naturalized.
Tala is seeking financial compensation for her client from the U.S. government. Rebecca Gambler has looked into the issue. She's with the U.S. Government Accountability Office, a nonpartisan group that advises Congress. She says that part of the problem is how immigration officers are trained to deal with possible U.S. citizens.
ICE policy requires supervisors to be present or consulted as part of the interview in cases where individuals claim U.S. citizenship, whereas the training materials don't include that guidance about consulting with a supervisor.
So there's a policy to be more careful, but nobody is trained to know it exists. ICE wouldn't comment on questions about detaining U.S. citizens, its training, or on any of the recent lawsuits against them. But Gambler says she's heard directly from ICE officials.
They agreed to take steps toward implementing our recommendation.
Meantime, Vasudha Tala, the immigration lawyer, says her client, Brian Buclay, is keeping a low profile, at least until his case goes through the legal process. He's dealing with mental health issues, Tala says, from his time spent in ICE detention.
And that's a place that Mr. Buclay finds himself returning to again and again, believing that he will be deported in fear of being separated from his family here in the United States.
A fear he shouldn't have, she says, resulting from the mistakes she hopes the U.S. government does more to avoid. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
Some 180 stolen artifacts valued at $70 million are being returned. They were the property of a billionaire hedge fund pioneer, but Michael Steinhardt will now have to surrender them. He's also been barred for life from acquiring other relics. That deal was struck with New York's district attorney. Christos Sirigiannis played a key role in identifying the stolen objects. He's a forensic archaeologist at the University of Aarhus Institute of Advanced Studies in Denmark. First, Christos, what kind of artifacts are now going to be returned?
All kinds of antiquities from 11 different countries, including Greece, Italy, Iraq, Egypt, countries that host remains of the great ancient civilizations.
So you're what's known as a forensic archaeologist. You specialize in identifying stolen antiquities. Tell us about your method. How do you work?
Well, I have two methods. The first one is to match objects to photographic evidence coming from archives confiscated from notorious and now convicted antiquities dealers and traffickers, even looters. The other method is based on identifying red flags and omissions, actually, in the collecting history, the so-called provenance of the objects, basically tracing the collecting history of an object as far back as even hundreds of years, and not the one that usually is offered by the antiquities market, even its highest levels, which often is incomplete and therefore very dangerous for any potential buyer.
So in the case of Michael Steinhardt, give us an example of how you identified like one of his stolen antiquities. What path did your investigation take you down?
One of the dozens of objects that I identified was a Greek, very rare marble statue, which passed through the hands of one of the most notorious dealers and antiquities traffickers of all time, Robert Hecht Jr., an American who dealt with the best objects around the world from, let's say, the mid-50s till the mid-90s, actually. I found incriminating photographic evidence in the archive confiscated from his flat in Paris in 2001 in an operation in a raid conducted by the French and Italian police authorities.
The kind of checking, the kind of investigation that you're doing, Christos, why is that not done routinely by galleries and museums and auction houses?
Because they don't want to, is the simple and straightforward answer. Everyone knows that the Italian and Greek authorities especially are holding copies of these archives confiscated from the traffickers. Yet, despite all the repatriations, hundreds and hundreds of them from the most famous museums, auction houses, dealers, galleries, private collections, the market and the museums and the private collectors, they still do not check their objects with the authorities. And it's very simple to send just an email and an attachment with an image of the object they are interested in acquiring soon or that they already have in their collection to see whether this object is illicit or not. And yet they do not want to do that because they don't want to find out or they don't want to alert the authorities against them or both.
Christos, are there a lot of Michael Steinhardts out there?
They are about a dozen collectors like Michael Steinhardt who have a lot of money. And they have invested a lot of money in art, often in looted art, and often in looted ancient art. My job academically is to study and map the trafficking networks in antiquities on an international level, but also at the same time, I feel a responsibility to help the authorities. And soon there will be more announcement from the DA's office in Manhattan about other cases, equally, if not more, important than Steinhardt.
Christos Sirigiannis is a forensic archaeologist at the University of Aarhus Institute of Advanced Studies in Denmark. He helped identify illegally purchased antiquities in the case against antiquities collector Michael Steinhardt. Christos, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And that is our show for this Tuesday. The World comes to you every weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and we'll see you right back here tomorrow.